Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Hi, and welcome to Sorceress, a podcast where I chat with authors and audiobook narrators about books, and especially audiobooks in the urban fantasy category. If you dig wisecracking wizards, conflicted lycanthropes, antagonistic undead, and all those other things that go bump in the night and then get bumped back, you're in the right place. So make yourself comfortable, salt the doors and the windowsills, and join me, James Anderson Foster, as we get to know the creators of this fascinating genre. Okay, so tonight I'm here with Chris Philbrook. He's the creator and author of Adrian's Undead Diary, the Reemergence series, Colony Lost, The Phone, and the fantasy world of Elmorin. God damn. I think I talk for a living or something.
Nailed it.
Actually, maybe I'll just leave this in. This will be the opening. Elmorin. Chris has several years of experience. No, okay, hold on. I got to read.
I'm sorry. Leah's like, good luck. I'm like, it's just fucking James. Sorry. Okay, ready.
All right, so tonight I'm here with author Chris Philbrook. He's the creator and author of Adrian's Undead Diary, the Reemergence series, Colony Lost, The Phone, and the fantasy world of Elmorin. Chris has several years of experience working in game development and editing, as well as writing fiction for several major game design companies. He has a business degree as well as a psychology degree. Chris has authored 9 novels in the horror post... Fuck me. Why does it have to be so long?
Summarize, man. Jesus.
Dude, right. Oh, fuck.
A load of stuff. Did things. How you doing?
Right, he did a lot of stuff. He wrote a lot. He's written a ton of stuff. Adrian's Undead Diary just dropped book 9. Book 10 is coming soon. 4 novels in the Reemergence series, 3 in the dark fantasy novels in the Kinless trilogy. That's the Elmorin. Fuck me. You know what? I'm going to record this later and then just splice it in. This is getting too hard for me to say, and it's late at night. I'm getting loopy. Chris, how are you, man?
I'm fantastic. I'm playing with matches.
Did you say playing with matches?
Absolutely. Yeah, I just found a pack of matches on my desk, and it looks like fun.
What could possibly go wrong?
Got me.
See, and this is what I think being an adult is all about. There's no one policing this crap that we do. I mean, like, aside from the police. But for the most part, you want to play with matches, man. Yeah, play with matches.
Fire is so pretty.
God. Oh, man. And then I'm going to get a letter from some attorney. All right. Some kid burned his house down. He said, author Chris Philbrook said the fire was so pretty. Woo! All right. So what's up, dude?
Writing books. Collecting fans.
A lot of books. Dude, so to prepare for this, you know, incredibly briefly... went out to Audible, and you've got 27 audiobooks.
Crazy.
That are either written by you, contributed to by you, or edited by you, and edited often has contributions by you as well. And then on Amazon, there are like 40-ish plus titles that you have either written entirely or edited or contributed to, or... Man, you're all over the place.
Yeah, I'm like air. I'm everywhere.
Right, and you've got 2 lovely daughters, a lovely wife. I can imagine all they ever see of you is like the top of your head over the laptop screen as you're sitting there writing. When do you have time?
I don't write. You know, sometimes I don't know. I was talking to my wife earlier about this, and she's like, "Well, you're just going to have to start working at night after the kids go to bed, because I have such a big backlog of things that I still have to do."
Mm-hmm.
And like, our youngest kid isn't really sleeping all that hot, and I do all the overnights. Like, for example, I woke up at 5 this morning because that's when she woke up. And here I am at 10 o'clock doing a podcast with James Anderson Foster, famous audiobook narrator. And I have.
I'm sorry, I missed that last part.
The James Anderson Foster, famous audiobook narrator.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for using some of your awake time to talk to me. I appreciate it. I understand how precious and valuable it is.
It is.
You could be doing so many other productive things right now.
You're right. You know, I own a PlayStation 4, right, which is my console of choice for video gaming. And I don't think I've turned it on in a year and a half. And I have games that I've never played. Like, I bought them. I got them at GameStop on, like, the buy one, get one half off thing. And they're just sitting on a shelf collecting dust.
You know, it'll get turned on in about 5, 6, 7 years as your oldest daughter says, Dad, what's this ancient thing?
Right, exactly.
What's this supposed to be?
Yeah, with our 5G connection.
Oh, man. So I mentioned in the intro that you write in, you know, the zombie apocalypse genre, urban fantasy, you know, strict urban fantasy, epic fantasy, sci-fi. I mean, you're really a horror, straight up horror. You're all over the kind of the weird fiction realm.
Yeah.
First off, do you have a favorite out of those? And then as a follow-up, what drives you to write in all of these? Are you looking for your groove? Is it just you follow whatever idea comes to you? Or, you know, how do you end up, you know, covering such a broad range?
It's such a layered question.
Thank you.
The big thing for me is I have a very vivid imagination, which I think all writers probably would say they have. My brain really struggles to shut off, so I'll be laying at night in bed, and my brain is still processing, you know, the ideas that I've got, the inspiration that I've got, and I have these, you know, lengthy sort of rabbit holes that my brain will go down, where I'll develop an entire plot for a story in 15 or 20 minutes, to the point where it's like, oh, I could turn that into a novel, no problem. And I tend to want to write the stuff that interests me, and the genre fiction stuff is the stuff that interests me to write. It's most fun for me, and it can encapsulate all of my different ideas. As far as, you know, am I trying to find my groove? Definitely. You know, I say this a lot, but I still believe that I'm, you know, kind of a no talent hack. And when I try and write in all these different genres, I get to play around in different kinds of sandboxes and sort of find areas of writing and styles of writing that challenge me and are more or less comfortable for me to write in. And it's sort of a way for me to test my own boundaries. What's my favorite? The urban fantasy stuff, probably. It's the easiest for me to write. I can kind of create my own world without having to do the homework of creating a whole world. You know, like, I can have magic appear in any city on Earth, and it can be fun, and I can play around with all different kinds of stuff, and it's awesome.
Nice. One of the things that I enjoyed in narrating Adrian's Undead Diary, that series, and that I hear a lot of fans mention and talk about, is your ability to take that zombie apocalypse genre and use it to really explore the human condition. You know, this is what the fans really seem to connect with. It's not just, you know, zombie apocalypse. It's not just, you know, survival horror. It's also, you know, really digging deep into the psyche of, you know, first Adrian and then his family as it grows, and then even, you know, the other people that he meets and interacts with that maybe might not be so friendly.
Right.
How have you used or have you used these other aspects of genre fiction to continue to explore the human condition?
Well, you know, you mentioned in the intro that I have a psychology degree, and the concept of human thought and emotion and reaction and our the machines that our brains are is just really fascinating. So when I sit down to write, I tend to put a lot of thought into what the emotional state and what the mental state of a character is. And I like to think about sort of describing things in ways that are deeply identifiable to people, which I think is one of the reasons why that character, Adrian, resonates with so many people, because he's a very genuine character. When I leave that genre and I write other stuff, what I try to do is have some kind of underlying social commentary, whether it be, you know, the villain or, you know, antagonist in a given novel is acting out because of very valid reasons, and to try and get the reader or the listener to react to the bad guy in a way that makes them say, ah, oh, you know, I kind of get why they're doing what they're doing. And, you know, with the reemergence in particular, the huge portion of all those books are about what would we do if everything in the world suddenly changed, and not an apocalypse. You know, in this case, in the reemergence, it's the reemergence of magic to the modern world. And, you know, when you start to introduce all these ideas of what magic would do to the real world, it does do some pretty crazy stuff. You know, the second book has a lot of vampires and stuff in it. And, you know, one of the questions that comes up is well, if you die and you're turned into a vampire and, you know, your will is enacted and your house is given away and all your worldly possessions are disseminated, and then you show back up as a vampire, well, what do you do? Now all your stuff's gone, you know, like, do you get it back? Do you sue? How does that work? Are you still a citizen? You were declared dead. So I, you know, I like to play around with practical stuff like that and sort of make people, you know, think about the way the world is and the way it could be, and think about their values and kind of challenge them.
Nice. Now, I know of three books in the Reemergence series, but in the intro it says four.
Right.
Is there something you're ready to tell people?
I'm really bad at math. Earlier today, I actually wrapped the fourth book in the series, which is called, each of the books in the series visits a new main character in the universe, and the main characters are all dragons. So the first book, the one that started the whole series, is called Tesser, A Dragon Among Us. And then it cycles to his brother and then his sister. And then book four returns back to Tesser. And it's called Tesser, A Father Enraged. Part of the plot of the series is that Tesser becomes a father. And in book four, his family is sort of attacked. So very excited for that one.
Nice. Nice. Does he get to pull a Liam Neeson?
He tries.
I don't know where you are, but. I mean, he's a dragon. He does have a very unique set of skills.
He really does. He really does. You know, someone once asked me or gave me a rash of crap about the fact that in the first book, Maddie, the girl that Tesser falls in love with, is essentially this like victimized woman who, you know, only exists to give Tesser someone to rescue. And to a certain extent, that's true. But if you really read between the lines, Maddie's kind of the hero of the first book.
Oh yeah.
You don't really find out till the very end, but she, without her, the whole book doesn't happen. And, you know, part of that is, how do you go after Superman? You know, how do you get Superman to do what you want? And, you know, you go after Lois Lane.
Yeah.
And, Tesser needed a Lois Lane, and she kind of fills that role. So.
Well, yeah. And honestly, I'm kind of stunned that somebody would see her as a plot point in the book, you know, and granted, I narrated Tesser, so I'm kind of invested in it. But I mean, when you think about it, what does it take when you find out the guy you're dating, the guy you're interested in, the guy, you know, like isn't a guy, but is a dragon in the form of a human being, and is very like out. We're not talking like secret identities, you know. This guy is like, you know, so I mean, you would think that the first instinct would be like, you know what, he's not that hot. I don't need that. I'm good. But she deals with it, and you deal with what this does to the relationship in the story, and how she struggles with it, and how he struggles with it, and then my God, they have a kid, and yeah. So I'm surprised that somebody would be like, "Oh, she's a plot point."
Well,
that's an unfair criticism.
Yeah, you know, some people don't like tiramisu.
What?
And I think that shit's delicious, and you can't please everyone.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, I know. It's a harsh one.
So, all right. I want to talk a little bit more about the Reemergence series and the Reemergence world, because I think not only is the idea fascinating, but there are so many little things that I think, you know, if people aren't paying attention, they're going to miss, that are either incredibly insightful or just really, really damn funny. Like, for example, in the very first book, Tesser basically learns to speak English by watching Jay and Silent Bob.
Right.
You know, and then you see that come out in various turns of phrases that he uses, things like that. And it's just, it's funny. And so tell me about how you went about creating this new aspect of the world. You didn't recreate the world, but you dumped magic and dragons on it. What brought this about? You know, what was the genesis for this? How did you plot it out? Where do you see it going? Basically just, you know, everything.
So back in, gosh, I think it was probably 1999, somewhere around there. My best friend, Alan McGraffin, and I used to play a lot of role-playing games together. A bunch of my friends did, but specifically this one references Alan. And I played a game where I played Tesser. Tesser was a character of mine. And in the book, he woke up beneath the city of New York and tried to integrate into modern society, similar to how Tesser does in the book. And we only got to play a few times before, you know, the game kind of got canceled or, you know, overtaken by the next one. And I asked Alan, well, what was your plan? You know, where was this campaign going? It's really cool. And he told me his you know, approximate plot. You know, fast forward 12, 13 years, whatever it was. And I always loved the idea of, you know, a sort of wise-assed cursing dragon that was, you know, filtering amongst humanity. And he had this massive role in keeping things supernatural in check. But he sort of blended in, and then they reached a point where he couldn't blend in anymore. He had to reveal himself. And I just thought that that was such a neat idea for a book. You know, this like ultimate alpha predator right in our midst that actually had humanity's best interests in mind. So when I sat down to, you know, write something new after the success of Adrian's Undead Diary, I said, you know what, that's such a cool story. I wonder if I could novelize it. So I, you know, I laid it all out, and I set down the rules for the world and how it would work. And it doesn't work exactly like it did in the game, but I sort of created this mythos of, the seven dragons. Tess was one of the seven, and how, you know, the various kinds of magic worked, and how I just thought it would be so much fun to have a dragon that had attitude and, you know, and could be funny and was also this terrifying creature when he really needed to be. And just from there, I just wanted to have fun with it. I just wanted to play with characters that, you know, could, you know, topple skyscrapers if they needed to. You know, like, how much fun is it to write Godzilla, right? And he's not as big as Godzilla, but he could probably give him a run for his money in my world. So I really wanted to take that idea from, you know, 12, 13 years ago and just sort of like apply it to today and run with it.
Nice. So it's planned to be a 5-book series, you said?
That's what I'm contracted for.
Okay.
They're selling pretty well, as best as I can tell. I think all 3 books right now are in the top 200 of fantasy on Audible.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you. And Audible continues to promote book 1 pretty heavily. So all 3 books kind of, you know, they're still going, and they wanted a book 4 and a book 5. I'm happy to write them. And as long as book 4 and 5 still sell, I'll keep writing them. You know, I'll probably write a couple at a time. And, you know, there's 7 dragons. And so far, with the 4th book, we're rewrapping around, because some of the dragons you really can't write a book about. But, there's at least one or two more dragons that I could write a book centered around. And then the, you know, the human characters of the reemergence are where, you know, I would say probably 80% of the story is. You know, Maddie, Tesser's, you know, for lack of a better word, wife, is a major character and can hold a book on her own. She, you know, she could have a novel on her own. And then there's an ex-cop that winds up getting involved in the whole thing named Spoon. And Spoon could absolutely hold a novel on his own.
Sure.
So as long as people keep reading and listening to them, I will keep writing them. And they are fun to write. And I'm happy people are enjoying them. I mean, as long as they can deal with some profanity. Because some people are souls that they can't hear an F-bomb every third or fourth page.
You know, it's not like you're using them like a comma or anything. So
you know what? Fuck them.
So, you know, I had a fan talk to me the other day, believe it or not, I found him. He asked me about the Reemergence series and asked if you had ever thought about or if you had plans to make it like a comic series.
It would be really cool, wouldn't it?
It would. As soon as he said that, I was like, hell yeah, I'd subscribe to that. That would be awesome. I would definitely read that.
Well, I got to, on a related note, I'm working with a local artist named Jason DeBee, who's incredibly talented, on a fantasy, like a sort of an epic fantasy comic book series. Right now that we have really high hopes for. And if that works out and we get some traction, I would love to take Tesser to the comic world. The story would translate really wonderfully.
Oh, it absolutely would. Yeah. So you mentioned that role-playing was sort of the genesis of this reemergence story. And I know that, you know, you wrote, you edited, you did game design for role-playing games as a profession before you started writing full-time. How much has that background sort of played into your novel writing now?
A ton. For people who are unfamiliar with role-playing games, they are, for all intents and purposes, a improv play. You know, you sit down around a table with three or four of your friends or, you know, more, whatever group you're comfortable with. And everyone at the table has a role to play. One person is the game master or dungeon master. And if you imagine it like a play, the DM or GM knows the approximate plot of the play. They know the beginning. They know some of the big scenes in the middle and they know the approximate ending. And everyone else at the table is playing a character in that play. And they know their character's motivations. They know their character's, you know, personalities. They know their character's, you know, hopefully they know them in and out. And the dialogue is made up on the fly based on what, you know, the players have decided their characters want to act like and speak like. So I did a lot of the GM and DM stuff where I would, you know, plot these games. And when I was working in development, I did a whole lot of, you know, scenario plotting that other GMs and DMs and people playing games would use as a skeleton for their sessions. And novel writing is, for all intents and purposes, the same damn thing. You know, you come up with a beginning idea, you come up with the character ideas, you come up with, you know, some of the really big scenes that you want to have happen, and you come up with a finale. And the difference is instead of sitting around a table getting a bunch of dialogue from some of your friends, you just control all of it. So it is, for all intents and purposes, like running an enormous role-playing game.
Nice. So I guess this question kind of goes along with both, you know, writing for role-playing games and for your writing now, especially the closer you get to sort of urban fantasy, right? What's the percentage you find that you're pulling from like traditional history and folklore versus just having to completely make it up on your own?
I try with the Reemergence series very specifically, I try to root things in some element of plausible history. A lot of the magics that some of the, you know, the spellcasters or shamans or whatever use have roots in some kind of real world history or real world practice. And also, you know, the locations are based on, you know, real mythology or real legends, or they're all based on, at some level, on something that is real and actual. You know, and it's fiction, of course, and obviously.
Yeah. Is that important to you?
Yeah.
That it have some basis in reality, or is it just it's easier to find it if it's already out there?
I think, I mean, it reads as more genuine to me. It feels more mm-hmm. believable, and I want to, you know, the hope would be is that people who are involved in this kind of stuff in the real world would hear it in the story or read it in the story and say, hey, wait a minute, he's talking about that thing. Or he put a spin on XYZ. And that's a lot of fun. Like one of the spellcasters in book one and two is a Russian character named Belyakov, and Belyakov uses minerals to kind of channel his magic. And if you get into, you know, the power inherent in stones that a lot of people believe heavily in, everything that he uses for spells follows some of the larger precepts of the people who do it in the real world. You know, so he uses rose quartz for healing. He uses, you know, granite for defensive spells, that kind of stuff. And it just, for me, it's a lot of fun to take something that's rooted in the real world, that's inspiring to me, and then add my own personal take and flavor on it, and then just kind of run with it with reckless abandon.
So tell me, is there any aspect of the supernatural, the paranormal, that you yourself believe in to any extent, or?
You know, I've had some experiences throughout my life that defied explanation, and that, you know, I'm a pretty rational person. I can think things through. I don't lose my calm. I don't panic much. I just, you know, pretty level-headed. But there have been a couple of things, you know, four or five things that have happened to me in my life that I cannot, for the life of me, come up with a rational explanation for. And, you know, we all hope, I think, on some level, that neat magical stuff or life after death happens, or that there are really, like, fantastical monsters out there that we could run into, because how cool would it be to see a friggin' griffin, right? But, you know, I don't know. I don't have explanations for some stuff, and I hope that the fantastic is the reason, because that gives me hope that there's so much more to this existence than just, you know, meat socks with personalities walking around until we rot away.
Right. Can you share one of those experiences with us?
The most recent one was probably 6 months ago, 8 months ago. My wife and I were upstairs in our house. We just bought a house a couple of years ago.
It was Congratulations.
Thank you. It was built in 1904 in rural wow. New Hampshire. It's an old house. Not the oldest house in town by far, but an old house. And we were sitting upstairs, and our two-year-old daughter was in her bedroom, which was the room right next to us. And we were talking, and our daughter was struggling to settle. And on the video monitor, you know, we were watching her, and we sat the monitor down, and we're talking, and then our daughter Willow was just, you know, chatting it up and, you know, doing her late night babble thing. And then both of us were sitting in the room looking at each other, and all of a sudden we heard a woman talking in her room, and she had an unmistakable Southern accent, and she said four sentences, maybe five sentences, and we couldn't quite make out what she said, but we knew, absolutely knew, that she was speaking in a Southern accent. And my wife looked at me and was like, did you hear that? And I said, yeah, what did you hear? And she's like, it sounded like a woman talking in a Southern accent in Willow's bedroom. And that was exactly what I had heard. And I opened the door and walked in, and our daughter was asleep. And the windows were shut, and there was no one in that room, and the only way in or out was the door that I was standing next to when it happened. And I have no idea what happened that night. the only thing we can think of is that, you know, there was a ghost, you know, some southern lady passed away in the house a long time ago, and she heard Willow was struggling to sleep, and she said some kind words to her, and Willow fell asleep and then was on her merry way.
You need to put that ghost on retainer.
Seriously, right? And, you know, we haven't had any southern voices since. We haven't had any weird, you know, interactions. The vacuum cleaner turned itself on once or twice, but we think that was because of a fuse inside the vacuum cleaner. But we cannot figure out what happened. And the fact that we both independently heard the same thing at the same time without corroborating it, you know, or coming up with the story ahead of time is pretty creepy.
Yeah.
But
awesome. That's an excellent story. Thank you.
You are very welcome. We are still kind of creeped out by it. Every once in a while when something weird happens in the house, we'll be like, damn southern lady. Bringing laundry.
Oh man, you know, you need to have a seance, get a Ouija board or a psychic to come out. And...
Yeah, I'm cool with that. I don't necessarily want to go down that path. She seems pretty happy with it. I don't want to ruffle the feathers of a southern belle. A dead southern belle, no less.
Right. Well, especially one that's, you know, apparently happy to help help get Willow to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, count our blessings, move on.
Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. So, I'm curious if, you know, you mentioned that you told us a little bit about book four and how it circles back around to Tesser in the Reemergence series. But Adrian's Undead Diary just started up again.
Right.
After the first eight books sort of, you know, like wrapped that story. You kind of took it as far as it was going to go and said, okay, this is the end. And then book nine just came out, and lo and behold, we're starting an entirely new set of stories with Adrian and these people in this world after, you know, the events of book eight. Can you tell us a little bit without giving too much away, unless you want to, feel free to give as much away as you'd like, of where this is going to go, what you want to explore in the post-apocalyptic series.
So spoiler alert, for those of you who haven't listened to or read the first eight AUD novels, Adrian kind of, let's just say he conquers the issue of the undead presence. And at the end of the eighth book, you're kind of left with the idea that, okay, you know, everything's going to be all right. And there's a couple of little, you know, red herrings and Easter eggs in there that give you, you know, the hope that there could be more stories. But, you know, Adrian's journey at the end of book eight is over. He's finished his, hero's journey, if you will. And, you know, took a big hiatus for a few years to kind of do some other projects, start the Reemergence, for example, write Colony Lost, and also to find, you know, more stories that were worth telling. Because I didn't want to restart the world unless the stories were going to be worth telling. And books 9 through 12 are what's called Adrian's March, which is a new storyline in that world. Book 9 specifically is called The Dealer of Hope, which is a Napoleonic quote about leaders needing to be dealers of hope. Not enough to just lead, you have to be able to inspire and give hope. Which is something that Adrian really starts to accept and come to grips with in book 9, because he has a following of people that he has kept safe for a couple of years, and he is looked up to, he is admired, and you find out in book 9 that he's actually built sort of like a, you know, for lack of a better word, like almost a cult of people who believe in him explicitly. And in book 9, he starts to deal with that. And he also starts to run into other groups of survivors who some are friendly, some are not. And, you know, trying to rebuild a world. And given the opportunity to rebuild the world, what elements of it do you trash? What elements of it do you keep? What ideals do you want to focus on? You know, more than just, okay, let's rebuild America. do you? You know, is America the ideal, you know,
thing to try and rebuild, or do we want to take some elements of it and reboot it in a better way? You know, this glorious experiment of the United States. And I think the new series really kind of experiments with, given this tremendous opportunity and responsibility to sort of decide how the next few years of his world is going to go. He has to actually decide. And of course it's never that easy, and, you know, stuff comes up and he experiences some pretty crazy, sort of incidents that guide and derail him at the same time. And it's a lot of fun because it's a deeply introspective series. You are inside Adrian's head almost every minute of the book. So you get to see a lot of that internal turmoil and his waffling and his impulsive nature and all of the different things about him as a person that affect him and sometimes make him make questionable decisions and also push him to make the right ones.
Nice. Now, along with, zombies, obviously, in the first series, you introduced a lot of very blatant supernatural themes in the first AUD series. Does that continue?
Absolutely. I talked about this a long time ago when the story was on the website, but it's not Adrian's zombie diary. It's Adrian's undead diary. And that word was chosen very specifically, very early on, because I knew from the start that it wasn't just going to be zombies. There were going to be other things, other forces at play. And they're definitely a minor part of the story compared to the zombies. But, you know, in book 8, there's a ghost. There's an absolute ghost that people interact with. And the amount of people who haven't picked up on the fact that that character is dead shocks me. I don't know if I'm a really shitty writer or a really genius writer, because that character blends in.
That's your M. Night Shyamalan moment right there.
Right. I don't know if that's a compliment. thanks. Anyway, moving on. It's AUD because there are elements of the supernatural that come up. And the ninth book it's kind of a void of spirituality in that sense, because, you know, a lot of what was causing these supernatural events to happen is kind of abated. But here, spoiler alert here, as book 10 comes out, you start to see that it is not gone. These elements are still at play. The forces of good and evil are still very much active, and they're not done with our hero, Adrian.
Awesome. And for folks that, I guess this is just a mild, I don't know, maybe this isn't a spoiler. You tell me, and if it's horrible, we'll cut it out if I'm not supposed to say anything about this. But for the folks that still want to get their zombie fix, there's another story that gets woven in with Adrian's story in book 9, and that's the story of his younger brother. And you start that story all the way back on that day one, September 23rd, right?
June 23rd.
June. Damn it.
Well, the diary itself starts on September 21st, so it's easy to
tell
because the numbers.
Thank you.
You are very welcome. Yeah, Tommy, Adrian's brother, was active in the military, and I knew that book 9 was going to be zombie-less. Because as I said, you know, Adrian, sort of cuts that problem off at the pass. And I thought, you know, I'd had most of the Tommy stories written for years and, had no home for him. And I thought, you know what, like I can absolutely include those in the new novels and allow people to still get their zombie fix while still watching Adrian, you know, become, you know, this leader that he wants to be. And that way I get to satisfy everybody. And so far, the feedback is phenomenally positive about the book. So,
oh yeah, yeah. So are Tommy's stories going to continue?
Yes. Yep. Okay. Yeah, only about half of the ones I had written showed up in The Dealer of Hope, and he's got, I think, 3 or 4 more that show up in The Last Resort, which is book 10.
Are you going to keep writing them?
Tommy stories?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. All right. I mean, I don't want to, like, I don't want you to give away any huge spoilers, but I mean, for me, taking off my narrator hat and putting on my fan hat, what I would love to see is, you know, these two brothers reunited. I don't know what you have planned. You haven't told me, but I would love to see, as these stories sort of parallel each other, you know, Tommy moving farther and farther in the future with each of his stories until eventually somehow, you know, they get reunited. And I'm sure I can't be like the only fan hoping that these two brothers, you know, get to see each other again.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty long line you're at the end of.
Right?
Well, you know, in the first eight books, again, spoiler alert, Adrian does manage to reunite with a good portion of his family, you know, against all odds. They wind up being survivors, and he mounts this, you know, effort to kind of move towards them and sort of accidentally finds them. So one of the things about him possibly reuniting with Tommy is it's kind of, you know, cliched, like, okay, you know, apocalypse hits and everybody in this dude's family lives. So that, you know, it could be hokey if they do reunite at the same time. You know, he's, for lack of a better word, he's kind of the chosen one, you know, and if any family was going to be protected and reunited, it would probably be his.
Yeah, you know, hokey be damned. I want them reunited. I don't care how hokey it is.
Duly noted. I'll write that story tonight before the bed.
Thank you. Because, you know, honestly, if you're just going to have a lot of pissed off people.
I'm used to
it. If they don't, yeah. Yeah, but I will call and yell at you. I don't know.
You do have my phone number.
Exactly. So we've kind of talked a little bit about how busy you are and how much writing you're doing. And, you know, you've mentioned your family and your two little girls. And with all of this time and energy that you're pouring into your work, what did you have to sacrifice to get to where you are today?
Not much. I've been incredibly fortunate. Stability, I guess, would be the big sacrifice. Being self-employed. Anybody out there who's listening who's self-employed knows that there's an enormous amount of risk that you take when you decide to live on the income that you generate. And writing is by no means any different than that. You know, certain publishers pay monthly, some pay quarterly, some pay every 6 months, some pay once a year. And if it all lines up that, you know, you had a bad quarter on the quarterly stuff, a bad 6 months on the 6 month stuff, and a bad month on the month stuff, on the month that all those come in, you don't make any money. So it's, you know, the stability has been elusive. And, you know, I as far as, you know, authors go, I do well. I'm able to provide for the most part. You know, money is tight, but you know, I've been lucky. I the first book I put out has hit number one in horror, and there aren't many people who can say that. And it's still a struggle, you know. But I really haven't had to sacrifice much other than that. I mean, I don't have like groupies smashing down my windows, so I haven't given up, you know, privacy. It is time consuming. I've given up a lot of spare time, but I love what I do, so it doesn't feel like a sacrifice.
Nice. So given what you write and you know what you did prior to this, your job prior to writing, I have to ask, and I ask everyone this, were you a weird kid?
One of my sisters pulled my mother aside when I was probably 14 or 15 and said to my mom, if you don't get him to stop playing Dungeons and Dragons, he's going to kill you.
Wow.
And, you know, this is back during the satanic panic of Dean.
Yeah.
When, you know, a couple people who were not well played and then wound up, you know, visiting harm on other people, but I wasn't that weird a kid. I really wasn't. I was pretty, read a lot of books. I played a lot of sports,
They made like an after school movie or something about that, didn't they?
Yeah, there was a Tom Hanks movie too.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember what it was called.
Oh, that was awful.
Yeah. But they were, trying to villainize it for a while there. I really wasn't that weird. I would say I'm a much weirder adult than I was a kid. Uh-huh. My parents moved a lot when I was younger. I tell the story, we moved 13 times before eighth grade. So up until the time I was 13 or so, I was always the new kid. So I tried to fly under the radar, and I was bullied mercilessly when I was a little kid. I'm a big guy and I was a chubby kid. And, I got picked on really, really badly. And I just wanted to be left alone. And I wasn't the weird kid. I didn't get picked on because I was weird. I think I was pretty normal. I mean, you could check in with some of the people I went to school with.
So the weirdness is a later cultivation?
Yeah, it aged, like cheese. I had the money to indulge my weird habits of book buying and research and travel and sort of cultivated the strange.
Nice. What's, I completely and totally lost my train of thought just thinking about, you likening yourself to cheese there.
Yeah. That's like cottage cheese, I should clarify. Not like a really nice Asiago or some imported Parmesan. I'm more like cottage cheese.
Well, my 3-year-old loves, like hard French and Italian cheese. And of course, all cheese is stinky cheese, at least all good cheese is. He just calls it stinky cheese. So, of course, as soon as you were like, I've cultivated aged like fine cheese. And immediately I'm thinking of my 3-year-old calling you stinky cheese. And I mean, really, how can I follow any train of thought other than that when that's going on?
Well, you know what? 3-year-olds know where it's at.
They do. They do. Stinky cheese, man. So I mentioned at the very beginning, 27 audiobooks.
Right.
Right, like the bulk of what you write has been recorded and produced in audio format.
Weird.
For you as an author who has, for the most part, created these worlds, these people, what is the coolest and or weirdest thing about hearing your stories narrated by someone else?
I remember, when the first book of AUD, which was the first audio project that went live, went out for auditions. And I remember getting, I forget what the number was, 32, 42 auditions for it, something like that, which didn't feel like a lot, but is in fact quite a few. And I remember listening to the first, 20, whatever, and thinking, God, these are horrible. These are weather forecasters, the people who are trying to sell stuff on QVC, just awful, awful, awful. And then I got your audition and that one other guy that we've talked about, and I heard them and thought, wow, that sounds really cool. That I would listen to that audiobook. And I remember having this moment where I felt convinced that if the book turned out like this audition, a lot of people are really going to like it. And I remember getting a chill, like getting that sort of like, hair standing on end moment of like, wow, this could really be something. That's arguably one of the coolest moments that I've ever had. The weird stuff is listening to you trying to pronounce things in some sort of a Boston accent. That's mostly painful. There's no downside to it. It's all amazing. It's all incredible. To me, this feels like showbiz, working in a different format. I can write stuff, post it on the internet, people will read it, and that's nothing special. But when you are working as a, you know, part of a team with a narrator and a producer, and people are listening to it in their car or on their phone. That to me feels like a production. This feels like, you know, I guess making it.
Heck yeah, it's absolutely showbiz.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you are no stranger to podcasts and interviews and so forth. Out of all the questions that you've had asked to you, what is something that you wish somebody would ask you? Like when you walk away with from an interview and you're like, you know, that was pretty good, but man, I really wanted to talk about this, or I wish somebody would just ask me this.
Great question. What's the question no one's ever asked me that I want to be asked?
Exactly.
A lot of podcasts and interviewers all have the same script. God bless everyone. But they always ask you, well, what are your inspirations? What led you to first start writing? And you just tick down the line and I'm happy to answer any and all questions for anybody because it's fun to do interviews. But it gets old and you want to talk about different things. I also, because of my success as a writer, I think I get asked a lot of business questions. You know, how do you make money? How are you full time? You know, blah, blah, blah. And those get old. Gosh, if someone wanted to ask me questions, or if I wanted someone to ask me questions, what would it be? How about what book or what kind of books would I write if I didn't have to worry about money? How about that?
That's a great question. What's the answer?
I'd probably write the same stuff. No,
that's an awesome answer.
You're giving me a little bit of grief earlier about the fact that I've written in a bunch of different genres and I'm kind of all over the place. And part of that is because it's fun. It's just fun to write different stuff. And I think, you know, one of the great things, I actually complained about this to my wife earlier tonight, is that I wish I just had this fat bank account and I could say, you know what, I'm going to take 6 months and just write something really weird and do something really fun and offbeat. And I don't care whether or not it sells. I just want to write it and get the idea out and let it live. And I have probably 4 or 5 full-on novel ideas that might never see the light of day because I have no idea if anyone will like them. And that's sad.
That is kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah. Huge ideas, characters, plots, starts, scenes, ends. I even know what I would like the covers to look like. And, you know, they might never see the light of day.
You got to write those.
If I can, I will, you know. But I got 2 girls, you know. They got to eat. As it is, you know, writing the stuff that I know people want to buy, the money is still... You know, like, I, you know, we're not going to go out and buy a brand new car anytime soon. So, you know, if I take 3 months or 4 months and I sink into an idea that has no guarantee of selling at all, yeah, what do I do then?
Yeah. Oh, God, risk sucks.
Yeah.
You know, because
that's the sacrifice, James.
Yeah, that's the sacrifice. But, you know, when I, as somebody who is not a writer, When I think about, you know, my idea of what an author is, my idea of being able to create, it would be like, it's like I hope that it's those passion projects where you're like, you know, I have no idea if there's an audience out there for this at all, but I've just got this whole thing in my head and I've got to get it out there. Like that you hope that new weird thing like just resonates, like, you know, that it's your passion that connects with people. And I don't know, I mean, I guess passion doesn't sign checks, but
well, I mean, it does, you know, to be a hypocrite. If you take something that you're really passionate about and you believe in it and you put the work in and you do the heavy lifting, you get success like what I've had. You know, the stuff that has sold well for me is the stuff that I was really excited about. And I had no idea it would build the following that it did. So, you know.
So what you're saying is you're going to pursue these projects.
Yeah, eventually. You know,
I've talked to you. I want full credit for having talked you into it right here on the podcast.
Boom. You are going to get a dedication.
That's all I want. And I want to narrate.
Absolutely. Deal.
Sweet. So, gosh, I completely lost track of time, and we are just about at the end of this hoedown here. Before I let you go, though, I mean, we talked about where AUD is going now. We've talked about at least the mid future of reemergence. Let's talk about Elmoran, the Kinless trilogy, and Colony Lost, which just has one book so far. Do you have plans for expanding these worlds and building these up?
Elmoran is probably wrapped where it is. That's another one of those passion projects that I worked on for years that that didn't really get the warmest of welcomes. I love those books. I think they're phenomenal. I think the world I created is just really interesting. But it's weird, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, turns out that me and a couple of hundred other people were the only people excited about it. So unless I find a way to free up, you know, 6 months of my time to, you know, write another novel in that world, just sort of for fun, probably won't see any more Elmoran. And then Colony Lost, was conceptualized as a standalone novel, you know, one and done, my glorious entrance to the world of military science fiction and horror. And it has phenomenal reviews, is loved by everyone who has listened to it or read it. But it hasn't sold a ton of books. Since I finished it, I have definitely gestated some ideas about turning it into a series, and I would love to do that. It's another really fun world that has a lot of potential for stories. And Audible has said to me that if I were to consider putting more books into that series, they would be interested in working on them with me. So the idea or the possibility that more books showing up in the world of Colony Lost, that'll probably happen. I also have an idea for how I want to do it that's notably different than anything else I've done, in terms of like packaging it and marketing it and how I'm going to write them. And, you know, I have to kind of figure all that out and see if it's a worthy idea. I think it'll be, but, you know, what the hell do I know?
Cool.
I'm making shit up for a living, James.
You know, I read the words that people make up for a living. So,
hey.
Awesome. Can you share any of that with us, or are you keeping it close to the chest for now?
For Colony Lost.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot at play, but the world of the basic story of Colony Lost is that there's a gas giant out there that has several moons orbiting it, and a generational ship departs Earth. And travels for 600 years, and finally arrives at this gas giant. And there was originally two ships. One was lost during the voyage, and the second ship colonizes these moons. I think four of them happen to be colonizable. And when they start to sort of put down roots, and they've got all these worlds to grow into, they realize that a lot of the minerals that we use today don't exist on any of these moons in any usable quantity. They just don't exist. A lot of the heavy metals that are important for high-tech gadgets. So they're basically faced with a ticking clock. You know, once their stuff starts to break, that's it. They don't have the means to make replacement parts. And the level of technology that they are enjoying is going to go away, and they will lose a lot of their progress. So there's another planet in the system that they attempt to colonize because probes indicate that it has some of these heavy metals. and they can basically risk colonizing a more dangerous planet, dangerous because it has a magnetic field that sort of messes with everything. And if they colonize this planet, they have access to all these materials that can allow them to salvage their sort of quality of life, salvage their technology, salvage their medicine, you know, yada, yada, yada. And when they land on the planet, it has sort of a species that they weren't expecting. And that's where the horror element kicks in. So for the future of Colony Lost, it's a whole world. It's an entire planet that these people could explore. And all of the main book, Colony Lost, takes place on one little peninsula of land on this enormous planet, you know, the size of Earth. And exploring that planet could be a wealth of written material. There could be all different manner of dangers that they could encounter, all different sort of opportunities. You know, the species that they encountered showed some signs of intelligence. Is there more intelligence to be found? Is this, you know, technically an alien race or just a creature on a planet? So yeah, that's kind of where the future of that series could go. Never mind the fact that the universe that these people on the moons have built for themselves is pretty complicated. You know, they have their own system of government and their own politics and their own, you know, backstabbing that goes on, you know, when people tend to organize into large groups. And that intrigue alone could be its own stories. But one of the things that I'm seeing that I kind of want to try out in the industry is there's been a huge transition to shorter novels. Most of my stuff tends to come in around, you know, 80 to 120,000 words, which is a traditional novel size. But it takes a really long time to write those books, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months to churn out a 100,000 word book. And what we're seeing is that the market supports shorter stuff, you know, like 50,000 words.
Sort of going back to serialization.
Exactly. Episode 1, episode 2, episode 3. And they, you know, the numbers that people are seeing is that the sales go up because the stuff is a little bit cheaper. So instead of selling, you know, 5,000 copies of a book at, you know, $5, let's say, you're selling 15,000 copies of a book at $3. And you're putting out a book every 6 weeks instead of every 3 months. And Colony Lost could really support that. I could easily write, you know, 10 or 20, you know, probably 30 or 40,000 word novels in that universe and really expand it and develop it. And I could walk away from it if they didn't sell. You know, I could write 3 or 4 of them in the time that I wrote one novel and really see if it would work. And I'm leaning towards giving that a shot.
Nice. That's a cool idea. I like it.
Yeah, you know, a couple of my friends are doing the serialization thing and they're having great luck with it. So, why not, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I know.
I lose my house. No biggie.
I work with John G. Hartness, who does a number of series, and he does serialized novels like that. He's cranking out like a novel, a novella a month.
Right.
And then at the end of like a major story arc, he just collects them all together.
Mm-hmm.
And then also releases, you know, like a boxed set, and yeah, seems to be working for him and his fans. So give it a shot.
Yeah. I'm excited to try it.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thank you so much for spending some of your very, very precious free time with me. I appreciate it so much. As more of the AUD and Reemergence books come out, and then possibly as Colony Lost picks up again, I hope you come back and talk to us again.
I'd be delighted, James.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right. You have a good evening.
You too.
And I want to make sure to give a shout out to our patrons and supporters, beginning with Dogan Foster, C. Stephen Manley, Colleen Jackson, Audiobooks After Dark, the podcast of Paul Stokes, and Zachary McElroy.
Thank you all so much. I appreciate your support so much. This wouldn't be possible without you. And if you'd like to support this podcast and get your name mentioned at the end of an episode, as well as a bunch of other cool supporter-only stuff, head on over to patreon.com/sorceress and sign up to support us at the wisecracking wizard level or higher. We'd greatly appreciate it. And that's it for this time. Thanks for dropping by. We really hope you enjoyed it and will come back and see us again. You can find Sorceress on iTunes, Stitcher, and our website, Sorceress. That's Sorcero.us. And you can find me at jamesnarrates.com, where you'll find a list of audiobooks, demos, and all the usual stuff. If you're enjoying Sorceress, please leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher, and if you're really enjoying it, it'd be mighty kind of you to drop a buck or two in the kitty. You can make a per-episode donation by signing up at patreon.com/sorceress, or you can make a one-time donation by visiting paypal.me/jamesnarrates. Any support, no matter how small, is greatly appreciated, and it'll help us keep on keeping on. So until next time, when things go bump in the night, remember to bump back.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.